I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Two days after the April 2015 uprising that followed the funeral of Freddie Gray, the Baltimore Orioles and Chicago White Sox played a game at Camden Yards. It was the only Major League Baseball game ever played without fans. What did the game mean to a city reeling from the worst violence since the death of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.? And what was it like for the players and the press to be the ones on the inside looking out? Kevin Cowherd was a longtime Baltimore Sun sports columnist and features writer. His new book tells the story of that historic day. It's called When the Crowd Didn't Roar, How Baseball's Strangest Game Ever Gave a Broken City Hope. Kevin Cowherd joins me when Midday gets underway right after these headlines. And welcome. It is indeed Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. As the Baltimore Orioles continue the long slog that constitutes rebuilding, empty seats abound at Camden Yards. People are staying away in droves this season as the Birds do their best to cultivate young talent who they hope will contribute to a winning team at some point in the future. But as bad as attendance might be this season, nothing compares to the attendance figure announced by Orioles media relations manager Jim Mosudek over the Camden Yards PA system on Wednesday, April 29th, 2015. Zero. What has come to be known as the uprising had crippled Baltimore 2 days earlier. With the National Guard stationed on streets throughout the city, cleanup crews of workers and volunteers picked up the detritus of the violence, and we began the long process of repairing our collective soul. Major League Baseball decided that the game between the O's and the Chicago White Sox scheduled for that day would be played with no fans seated in the ballpark. It has been the only Major League Baseball game ever played without fans. Kevin Cowherd was a Baltimore Sun sports columnist and features writer for 32 years. His latest book tells the story of that surreal game on that unparalleled day. It's called When the Crowd Didn't Roar, How Baseball's Strangest Game Ever Gave a Broken City Hope. He joins me today in Studio A. Good to see you, Kevin.
Nice to see you again, Tom.
And ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to join us, if you were one of the people holding a ticket to that game, we'd love to hear from you. We've got a tweet from one listener who posted a picture of the tickets to that game. If you were one of the people that went down to the stadium and stood outside and kind of peered in, but wasn't, of course, allowed in the game, we'd love to hear from you. And we'd love to hear your reactions to whether or not you think ultimately it was the right call to disallow fans from being in the stadium that day. This is just 2 days after the uprising that happened on Monday night, April 27th, 2015. This was a game, I guess, was it Wednesday or Thursday?
It was a Wednesday game.
Yeah. So 2 days later. So our number here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet at @midday_WYPR. And Kevin, I got to tell you, when you told me about this book, I thought, there's some books that really should be just really long New Yorker articles. How can you write a book about a game, you know? But I got to tell you, man, you pull it off. This is a really,
Appreciate that.
A fascinating read. What were you trying to do? Because this is more than just about the game they played that day.
Yeah, but I mean, the circumstances back then, Tom, were so unbelievable. You know, you really have to go back to that April 2015. And you have to know what a fraught and chaotic time it was here in Baltimore. So, you know, the story basically starts with the tragic death of a 25-year-old African-American named Freddie Gray from injuries suffered in police custody. His death, of course, had come on the heels of a number of other African-American men around the country who had died after questionable encounters with law enforcement. So you had the death of Eric Garner in Staten Island, Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. You had the death of Tamir Rice in Cleveland. You had the death of Walter Scott in North Charleston, South Carolina. So it was no surprise that after Freddie Gray's death, there were a number of demonstrations here in the city. And you'll recall that they were mostly peaceful until the night of April 25th. And that was when a number of demonstrators descended on Camden Yards.
That Saturday night.
That was a Saturday night game.
Before the Monday night, which we now remember as the uprising.
Right.
This is 2 days prior to that night.
Two days prior. They're there as fans are coming in to see the Orioles play the Red Sox, Boston Red Sox. Boston Red Sox travel well, so you have a ton of people showing up at this game. And there were a number of incidents that happened outside the stadium. There were bar patrons along Washington Boulevard fighting with some of the demonstrators who came. Then there was two police cars that had been trashed, a number of storefront windows trashed. So that was the first sense that something was going to happen in the city. That there was a first sense of how tense things were in the city. Okay. 2 days later, of course.
Although people ultimately, you know, decided that, well, okay, that's passed. Because I remember watching that on television, local television at that point. It wasn't CNN and Fox and all that stuff.
Right.
But by Sunday, that had all calmed down. So people kind of thought, well, okay, that we had a few little, you know, unrelated incidents.
To a degree. But up in Gobin's, where Freddie Gray's body was laid in state, that was a very tense scene up there. So you still had a sense that something could occur. By Monday, of course, you have
the
Freddie Gray
funeral. Right.
And following the funeral is when all hell broke loose. And we had the worst rioting in the city of Baltimore since the death of the Reverend Martin Luther King in 1968. But 2 days later, Tom, you have this, you know, with National Guards troops in the streets, with the smell of burned cars and buildings still in the air, with shattered glass from storefronts in the streets, with tanks rumbling through West Baltimore, the Baltimore Orioles and the Chicago White Sox played a game in lockdown Camden Yards.
And they almost played a game on Monday night, the night of the uprising.
Well, yes. I mean,
they didn't cancel that game
until
on
about
the
5 o'clock.
Until about 5 o'clock.
Yeah.
And the stuff that started with kids from Douglas High School going over to Mondawmin Mall and then
right.
in that area, that didn't start until late in the day. I mean, it was after school, 3:30, 4 o'clock.
Yes, but it quickly became apparent by about 4:30, 5 o'clock, the Orioles were not going to get this game in. They quickly emptied the stadium, told both teams to go home, and that was the end of that. It was the following day, so that was the first game of that three-game series that was canceled. The following day's game, Tuesday, was also canceled. But by 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the Orioles were coming out with statements saying, hey, we're going to try to play the next day's game in lockdown Camden Yards. And this was greeted with incredulity. No one could believe they were going to play a game in a locked stadium with no fans.
Who made that decision? Is it the Orioles themselves? Is it Major League Baseball? Was it the city of Baltimore?
All of the above.
Mayor's office,
the
police?
All of the above. Police department, mayor's office, Baltimore Orioles, Major League Baseball all got together. And the sense was that we could make up those first two games with a doubleheader somewhere down the road. But, you know, the baseball schedule is a mosaic, Tom. You take games away from here, you got to make them up over here. So it was finally decided, if we can get this game in, that would be good for the scheduling for Major League Baseball. But the Orioles and the city fathers and the mayor's office and the police also felt that this would be like almost a step towards some form of normalcy. You're playing a game in a locked stadium with no fans, but at least you're playing baseball downtown. So all of these factors contributed to this decision to ultimately play the game. Locked gates, no fans.
So they played it Wednesday afternoon.
They did.
And, you know, and then we'll talk about what happened during that game and after. Let's go to the phones. Kevin Cowherd is my guest. The book is called When the Crowd Didn't Roar, How Baseball's Strangest Game Ever Gave a Broken City Hope. Let's hear first from Wick in Georgetown. Wick, welcome to Midday with Kevin Cowherd.
Hey, how y'all doing?
Doing great.
So I was just kind of giving you my two cents on the issue. I was working in Annapolis at the time and got off work early for some reason and heard that the game was going on. So at some point in the middle of the game, I just came by and parked whatever that street is in the outfield where you can kind of look in through the bars.
Yep, Camden Street.
And, yeah, what's that?
Camden Street.
Yeah, so I just parked around there and there were a few dozen fans there and just kind of checked the game out. It was weird looking in and seen nobody inside.
Yeah, Kevin writes about that group of folks that out there. I mean, how much could you actually see sort of peering in through the fence? I mean, Wick, what was your experience? How much could you see?
Yeah, well, not a lot because, you know, you're way out there. But, you know, you could see people playing baseball, and there was just a couple people in the stands that I assumed were reporters or somehow involved with the team. And it was interesting looking up and seeing, you know, you can see the announcer in the box. And you could really hear, like, the crack of a ball, you know, like, as you normally wouldn't hear it echo around quite so much.
Yeah. I mean, about how many people were out there?
Well, numbers ebbed, swelled. Probably at the start of the game, were probably a couple of dozen. At one point, there were probably four or five dozen. But, you know, Wick brings up a good point. Those fans were diehard fans for showing up, obviously. And they did not have a good view. That gate that they stood behind, Tom, is near the monuments, that, you know, the monuments of the Oriole legendary players, Hall of Fame players, and you only see about half the field.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, these fans were loud, they were raucous, they were into it, they understood the gravity of the situation. There were people there holding up signs saying, "Don't forget about Freddie Gray." But these fans wanted to make themselves heard, and the Orioles could hear them. I mean, it sounded like people were cheering for them in Wyoming. But nevertheless, the Orioles appreciated these fans that did show up.
And you were at this game, right?
I was not.
Okay.
No.
So I
was downtown that day, but not at the game. No.
I've seen tape of the stadium, you know, where they pan across, you know, this empty house. I mean, it's really quite extraordinary.
It's amazing.
But you've been in that stadium many times prior to games, way before anybody starts filling. So you know the vibe of that space when there's nobody in it. I mean, you're there before batting practice. You're there before the players are even out of the locker room.
Yeah, yeah. But this was totally different from even that vibe. And what made it so different was it was so surreal. So many. First of all, if you read the book, you'll find out none of the players on either team enjoyed playing in this atmosphere. Okay, for the most part, the players whispered to each other throughout the game because it felt like they were playing ball in a chapel. Every shot off the bat, the crack of the bat, every shot sounded like it was a ball that was going to hit the warehouse wall. Instead of just a ground ball to second base or a single to right field. So that was unnerving for the position players out in the field because they didn't know, you know, how hard the ball was being hit. So the silence was eerie. At one point, Buck Showalter calls for a relief pitcher. 400 yards away, the phone in the bullpen rings, and it sounds like a fire alarm going off.
Everybody can hear it.
Everybody can hear it.
Right.
And so that was the silence, Tom. But even when the silence was broken, it was unnerving because the silence was broken by news helicopters and police helicopters clattering across the sky, by military Humvees going past on Camden Street, by the cries of angry demonstrators who were at City Hall that day. By the continuous wail of sirens.
Sirens all the time.
So it was, when it wasn't quiet as a chapel, there were sounds that no ball player is used to hearing constantly throughout nine innings.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones again to Mark in Towson. Mark, welcome to Midday with Kevin Cowherd.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Mr. Cowherd. I've read many of your columns. I enjoy most of them.
Thank you for that faint praise.
To a certain degree, looking at things from a positive attitude, but I can tell you that I couldn't disagree with you more that the playing of a game in front of with no fans in the stadium represents a sign or a symbol of hope in any way, shape, or form. That image of an empty stadium is the image that people will remember. It went all across the globe. It was on the front page of many newspapers, including The Sun. And that image represented, as far as I'm concerned, an image of failure and capitulation. And I think the Orioles and Baltimore City made a terrible mistake in playing that game at all. And the Orioles should have said to Major League Baseball, "We can't play. Either give us a postponement or we will forfeit the game." And a forfeiture goes out over the images of the internet and the newspapers all across the country as three words: the Orioles forfeited. That's not an image that burns in people's mind. There is no picture of a forfeiture or a postponement. So the optics were horrible. I mean, they already had horrific optics with rioting in the streets, which obviously was a terrible situation, and I understand. And I appreciate the fact that the book and which I intend to read, will go into all the details and everything about the game, and it's all very interesting. But the subtitle that represents any kind of hope to any onlookers, I just don't get.
Well, I'll respectfully disagree with you. Appreciate your point, but disagree. First, let me address this issue of hope. The hope that I talked about really was the hope that was found in the city late on Wednesday after this game had been played. And at that time, there was the feeling, the hope was that the worst of the unrest was over and that the city wasn't irretrievably broken and that things were going to get better from that point on. So that's the hope I was talking about. It was fleeting. It turned out to be fleeting. 4 years later, we know that Baltimore still has many, many problems. As to the optics of a baseball game, I think the Orioles made the right decision, so I'll disagree with that caller. It was too dangerous to play a game there, and but from the people that I've talked to over the years, almost everybody that I've talked to thought that that was a positive, that the Orioles got a baseball game in. Now, sure, there's a lot of people like your previous caller who disagree with that. But for most of the people that I talked about, it was almost this sense of, hey, they're playing baseball again. I talked to Kwesi Mfume, who is quoted in the book, former NAACP president and former Maryland congressman. He thought that game was a positive for the city. And he actually joined, Tom, he joined those fans behind the left center field wall, behind the locked gates.
Yeah.
And it brought a sense of hope to him that the worst of the unrest was over and that maybe we can get on with it and maybe this city is not irretrievably broken.
I'm interested. Mark, do we still have you? Are you still there?
Yes.
Yeah. When you say it represented capitulation to what?
Capitulation to the fact that the city was under siege, that they could not control the situation, and for the safety of all concerned, they had already postponed postponed two games. And I think to play a game where you're saying, we can't guarantee your safety to come and watch a baseball game, so we're going to play it with nobody there. It's in the record books. It's never happened before. Likely will never happen again. It will go in as the Orioles doing something because of failure. I mean,
I'm interested, Mark, in how forfeiting the game wouldn't be even worse capitulation. That's interesting to me that the metric
no
for capitulation.
But there's no optics when you forfeit a game. There's
yeah, so it's about how it looked. Uh-huh. Yeah, interesting. All right, well, Mark, I appreciate that call. Thanks so much. Kevin Cowherd is the author of When the Crowd Didn't Roar, How Baseball's Strangest Game Ever Gave a Broken City Hope. That's how Kevin Cowherd sees it. That's your story, and you're sticking
I'm
to
sticking
it.
Sticking to it.
We'll have more with Kevin Cowherd after this quick break. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. To drop us a tweet, @MiddayWIPR. To follow me on Twitter, @TomHallWIPR. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our broadcast, it's Midday at the Movies. So to mark the 75th anniversary of the D-Day invasion, our movie mavens, Jed Dietz, he's the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival, and Anne Hornaday, she's the film critic for the Washington Post. They're going to take a look back at some of the best war movies. Plus, theater critic Jay Wynn Russick reviews The Play That Goes Wrong at the Hippodrome Theater in Baltimore. Speaking of things that go wrong, I'm here in Studio A, as I am every day from Monday through Friday at noon. And if you've just joined us, Kevin Cowherd is my guest. His latest book is called When the Crowd Didn't Roar, How Baseball's Strangest Game Ever Gave a Broken City Hope. We're talking about the game that the Baltimore Orioles and Chicago White Sox played in a nearly empty Camden Yards 2 days after the violence and uprising that followed the funeral of Freddie Gray in 2015. To join our conversation with your reflections on the decision to have the game, to lock out the fans, your memories of that time in our city's history not too long ago, just 4 years ago. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. You can drop us a tweet as well, @MiddayWIPR. Here's a clip from the opening of the broadcast of WGN television, the Chicago White Sox announcers, starting the broadcast that afternoon, April 29th, 2015.
Hi, everybody, and welcome. With Steve Stone, I'm Ken Harrelson, as we get set to bring you a little bit of baseball history this afternoon. We're going to play a regular season championship game with nobody in the stands. Nobody's going to be allowed into the ballpark except the media and a few scouts and people of that nature. But the commissioner really made, Rob Manfred, made a really gutsy and correct decision, because he canceled the game on Monday and then canceled the game on Tuesday due to safety concerns. And believe me, there were plenty of them going around Baltimore, Steve. It was just a chaotic thing. But this afternoon, we got a pitching change. It was supposed to be Hector Nwesi. It's going to be Jeff Samardzija.
Jeff Samardzija going to the mound for his fifth start.
So Kevin Cowherd, there they go. They say, well, you know, Rob Manfred, the commissioner of baseball, made a gutsy decision.
Made a gutsy decision. And here's the pitching change.
And here's the pitching change. They couldn't care less. No. I mean,
not a great setup there. Yeah. You know, they're out of town broadcasters, obviously. They're the Chicago guys. But, yeah, you would think that they would try to paint a picture of the scene and what was happening in Baltimore that day.
Because they had been locked in their hotel room for the past 72 hours.
Absolutely.
I mean, they were here for the game on Monday, which didn't get played. They were here for the game on Tuesday, which didn't get played. So they certainly were watching television.
Oh, yeah.
They understood what was going on and pretty much right outside their hotel
room. And they flew in Sunday night. So they had a full dose of what was happening in Baltimore. And as you pointed out, alluded to earlier, the coverage was extensive, right? I mean, you know, network TV, cable TV. So they were certainly aware of this fraught, chaotic time, what Baltimore was going through, and yet I guess they wanted to talk about the pitching changes. Yeah,
evidently, you know. Let's go back to the phones to Brandy in Baltimore. Brandy, welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. As an African-American woman with an African-American son who lived in Baltimore and lived in Baltimore my entire life, I thought it was very disrespectful for the Orioles to play that game. In the wake of so much racial tension, it didn't make me feel like the city really had our best interests at heart. It made me feel like we're going to get on with business as usual. And it wasn't business as usual. It was a very traumatic time for myself and my family, as I explained to my son, who at the time was only 6 years old, why there are tanks rolling through. He still had nightmares about the fires that were going on. And to just see what, in my opinion, was such a callous attitude, it just was really disrespectful, and it was disheartening. I'll take you all's comments offline. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you, Brandy. I really appreciate it. And, you know, of course, understanding the cognizance of what a decent interval is a difficult thing to ascertain. You know, how long is too long, how short is too short. But that's a really, really important comment from Brandy.
Yeah, and of course the Orioles considered, you know, all sorts of other ways to get this game in. Baseball in the past has canceled games because of the Rodney King unrest in 1992. After the Rodney King verdicts, the Dodgers canceled their series with the Montreal Expos. And I said there's been other instances of this kind of thing. You know, September 11th, the terrorist attacks, Bud Selig canceled baseball for a week. You know, I know there's people out there who don't agree with the Orioles' decision, and you could certainly hear it in her voice. It was a terrible time in the city. There's no question about it. The Orioles actually felt like they didn't feel that this was a disrespectful move, although you can understand how people could think that way. They felt that this was a tiny step in maybe helping the city to heal a little bit, and again, trying to get a game in that doesn't disrupt the whole. So it was naked commerce again. I mean, there's no question about that in terms of getting the game in. But there were, you know, obviously no concession stands, no parking. The Orioles aren't going to make the kind of money that they made that day. So,
well, but there were some city officials who very much thought it was a bad idea to leave the fans out. Not only did they think that the game should be played, they thought it should have been open. I mean, Nick Mosby, who represented
that district, and also, Bernard Young, Jack Young, who was the city council president, who now our mayor. felt
Brandon Scott, you're right about him.
Brandon Scott thought that the Orioles made the right move. But Nick Mosby and Jack Young felt that that game should have been played as a regular game. Concession stands open, fans allowed in, parking the whole bit. I totally disagree with them. I disagreed with them back then. I think the city was still too tense, too dangerous. You could not have fans come in. And as Kwesi Mfume said, how can you square the image of a ballpark filled with cheering fans just a few miles from this terrible, chaotic situation that took place in West Baltimore? You just couldn't. You couldn't square that image.
And when Camden Yards is full of screaming fans, they're mostly screaming white fans.
Major League
Baseball has had an issue not only attracting black and people of color to the stands, but also even to the teams.
The number of African-American players has really diminished over the years, has dwindled over the years. And yes, the Orioles are trying, just like other teams in baseball, they're trying to get more black fans into the stadiums. They know it's a problem. They know it's an issue, and they're working on it.
Who was actually in the stadium? I mean, there were some, the press was there. I mean, and some of the people who work for the Orioles and stuff. I mean, for example, was there a game announcer, a PA announcer?
Yes,
of course. So they announced every batter that came up to the plate?
Yes, so the press box was filled with about 110 people, media people from all over the country and all over the world, actually, who were there to cover the game. There was a guy, a man who was running the radar gun for pitchers and the scoreboard in the stadium itself. There were something like 6 Baltimore police officers there to keep order. They were told by the Orioles to stay out of sight. The Orioles didn't want to celebrate this game. They just wanted to play this game and get it over with. And so then you had the normal contingent of TV and radio crews. But a very limited amount of people in that stadium that day.
Was the Star-Spangled Banner sung?
The Star-Spangled Banner was sung. They got rid of certain walk-up music for the batters was played, but they got rid of things, Tom, like the kiss cam and the condiment races and all these other goofy filler things. They got rid of all those types
of things. Was the organist there?
There was no organist. There was Take Me Out to the Ball Game was played for the 7th inning stretch, as was the John Denver song.
Thank God
I'm a country boy. So they kept up appearances, if you will, on certain things. And in other things, there was too many things, scoreboard-related things, that they knew they had to cut out.
Ladio tweets us a photo standing outside the gate during the game, singing the Star-Spangled Banner out there. That was both eerie and beautiful. It definitely felt like a historic moment.
Yeah, it was.
Didn't seem to feel like too much of an historic moment to Ken Harrelson and Steve Stone of the WGN announcing team.
Yeah, they just plunged right into their game broadcast,
The people who were there in the press box, and even, you know, the ushers, the people who were around the stadium, those 6 Baltimore City police officers.
Yes.
They knew that this was something extraordinary and this was an historic event.
Oh, absolutely. Everybody did. But everybody approached this game with such tremendous uncertainty, Tom. Nobody knew what this was going to be like. And everybody wanted to know, if you were a reporter, you wanted to cover this game. You wanted to know what this was going to be like. One guy who definitely wanted to know was Cal Ripken Jr.
Yeah, he called Dan Duquette. You're right about
that. Right. So Dan Duquette is doing that day.
He's the general manager of the Orioles at the time.
Former general manager of the Orioles. He's doing a interview with Mike Barnicle for MSNBC outside the stadium. The two had known each other for years in Boston. Duquette had been the GM of the Boston Red Sox. Mike Barnicle, of course, star columnist for the Boston Globe. Duquette wraps up this interview right out in front of Camden Yards, turns around, and there's somebody going by on a bicycle. It's Cal Ripken Jr. Cal Ripken Jr. stops. The two of them start talking, and Cal says something to the effect of, hey, you know, I can't imagine what this is going to be like. I'd love to see this game. I've never played in front of 0 fans. So Duquette actually invited him up to his box to watch the game with Dan and his family, and that's what Cal did. So, yeah, I mean, even people, Hall of Famers, had no idea how do you play a game in a major league ballpark with nobody there, with no fans.
Kevin Cowherd, the book is called When the Crowd Didn't Roar, How Baseball's Strangest Game Ever Gave a Broken City Hope. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Our number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. Let's go to Oscar in Chestnut Ridge up in Baltimore County. Oscar, welcome to Midday.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear about this because I heard the gentleman speak a couple weeks ago up in our area, and he talked about what he did, and I think it's great because what happened was I talked to him about this is not really a bad thing; it's a good thing because. We looked at what's going on today, and a lot of people think this is the worst turnout we've ever seen. But that's not the worst turnout. The worst turnout was the turnout that we're talking about today, which happened. And what I did, since I'm going five times a year to see the game from a friend of mine who's got good seats, I went out and bought his book. And so that's the one that's it's really the worst. It's not what we're having today, the poor turnout. Of course, the worst turnout is the one that this book talks about.
Right.
And I think that's something people would like to have if they're the guest somewhere.
Well, I appreciate that call, Oscar. And, of course, the attendance this year for the Orioles is dismal, and they're playing dismally.
Right.
They won last night 12-11.
Yes.
I watched the first four innings. They were up 6-2. I thought, well, they're on their way. And then I go to sleep, and the bullpen blows it again.
Same thing. They're up by, like, two touchdowns. I say, okay, this game is over. And then I wake up, and I find out it was a nail-biter all the way to the end.
It was a nail-biter.
It was amazing.
The other team gets 11 runs, and they still figured out a way of winning. They played the Texas Rangers last night in Texas. Adam Jones, speaking about the paucity of African-American players on the field and in the stands.
Yep.
Adam Jones, whose father-in-law still lives here in West Baltimore.
Yeah, Gene Fugit, the former Washington Redskin Dallas Cowboy tight end.
Yeah.
A great man, and he actually sat in with me when I interviewed Adam Jones once at Adam Jones's house.
Because Adam Jones made some remarks to the media. You talk about his remarks. You talk about the remarks that Peter Angelos and even Buck Showalter made. But Adam Jones's position in this whole enterprise is unique because he's a team leader, first of all, and he's one of the few African-American players on the team.
Well, he's one of two African-American players on the team, the other being Delmon Young. And Adam Jones was the guy who, he was the go-to guy for all the other Oriole players. When the first disturbances were the first disturbances outside of Camden Yards before the Red Sox Orioles game, players started coming up to Jones and saying, "Jonesy, what's going on here? What's happening with the unrest? What's happening with these demonstrators?" And he was the one who kind of clued them in. Look, these are moneyed young ball players who don't venture up to West Baltimore, okay? And they wanted to know what was happening. And then once the unrest hit on Monday, Jones was the guy who everybody went to and said, "Hey, can you tell us what's going on?" So by Wednesday, Jones knew. He felt that it was his job as a team leader, one of only two African-American players, to address the media. And so that day, he went to the Orioles and said, "Could I address the media at some point before the game?" And he did. And he spoke eloquently about these demonstrators. And he tried to show these mostly middle-aged white media people why this was happening in the streets of West Baltimore. And he tried to touch on the poverty, the neglect, the despair, gangs, drugs. He tried to touch on all that to say, and also lost jobs, PAL centers closing. So he touched on all that. He was eloquent, and he did his job that day. He was Adam Jones. There were occasions where he almost resented being the guy who, like this African-American oracle who was supposed to explain things all the time to the white media. But he embraced that day, and he did a fabulous job.
Kevin Cowherd, the new book is called When the Crowd Didn't Roar, How Baseball's Strangest Game Ever gave a broken city hope. We'll have a quick break and more with Kevin when we come back. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet at @midday WYPR. And you can follow me on Twitter at @TomHallWYPR. Stay with us. Matt, I'm Tom Hall. Before we get back to our conversation with Kevin Cowherd about the extraordinary game played 2 days after the riots and uprising in 2015 between the Orioles and the White Sox. The Orioles won that game, by the way, 8-2. A word about an announcement from Baltimore Mayor Jack Young and the Baltimore City Recreation and Parks Department. They have a new thing happening in July, next month, and it's an Olympic-style sports tournament for teens, teens between the ages of 12 and 14. They're going to have competitions in soccer, basketball, track and field, and tennis. They're going to work with the mayor's office and each individual council district, so they will represent the district in which they live, and they will compete for the coveted Charm City Cup. There's an opening ceremony at City Hall on the 13th of July. That's a Saturday. And then the games will start the following day for a week, from the 14th of July through the 20th. So this is the inaugural version of the Charm City Games. So parents can register their kids by going to a website that we will post on our website. And registration is open now through Friday the 14th. So you got about 10 days or so, 9 days to register your kids for the Charm City Games, and we'll post a link to where you can register your children for that. So if you have just joined us, Kevin Cowherd is my guest. He was a reporter, a features writer, and a columnist for the Baltimore Sun for more than 3 decades. He wrote 6 baseball novels for young readers with Cal Ripken Jr. and many other books. The latest is called When the Crowd Didn't Roar, How Baseball's Strangest Game Ever Gave a Broken City Hope. You can join our conversation at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. Let's go to the phones to Alan in Towson. Alan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I don't know if Kevin investigated this, but during the Martin Luther King riots in 68, I swear the Orioles played a game. I was told by my mother I couldn't go to the game. I had to go to work with my father, who worked at owned the vending machine company on Greenman Avenue right next to the State Pen.
I'm not aware of that. What I can tell you is the start of that season, the 68 season, was delayed 2 days because there were a number of players led by Roberto Clemente, the great Pittsburgh Pirate outfielder, and Bob Gibson, the great pitcher for the St. Louis Cardinals, who wanted to attend Dr. King's funeral, and they wanted the season pushed back until they could do so. But I will look into what you're saying. I'll see if we can't track that down.
Let's go to Frank in Baltimore. Frank, welcome to Midday with Kevin Cowherd.
Thank you, Tom. Enjoy your show. I'd have to agree with Tom and what your comments in the beginning that this would have seemed like a good long New Yorker article. But I think the in terms of the topic of a book, yes, there were the optics. That was very dramatic. That could have been a launch pad. But it seems to me, as you're discussing now, and I've not read the book, but the story is in the two different perceptions of what happened. I remember the media was taken to task in the beginning by calling them riots, and then we settled on unrest because there was no comparison with what happened in 1968. Even on television, it was clear that there were demonstrators who were loud and raucous, but then there were a group of opportunistic young criminal people that did the violence and the looting and this and that and the other, and those were two separate things that were conflated. But more importantly, that the Baltimore response to have tanks and National Guard in West Baltimore and police downtown protecting that hub of the white entertainment district, Harbor Place and Camden Yards. And that it seems to me that the book would look back on those two views of where they were and where they've led us to give us some threads of thought to go forward, because, you know, there's a lot in Baltimore. We're in trouble on a lot of big areas, Harbor Place about to go into receivership, et cetera, that we can find a way forward from that divide to which the empty stadium baseball game was merely a footnote.
Yeah, well, thanks, Frank, for that comment. I appreciate it. Kevin, one of the things you write about is Peter Angelos, the white son of
John
Angelos. John Angelos, the son of Peter Angelos.
Yeah, yeah.
And his remarks, which got national attention, and they were surprising to many people in Major League Baseball, to be
Yeah, sure. When the violence first started the Saturday night outside of the of Camden Yards as the Orioles prepared to play the Red Sox, it was John Angelos who tweeted out, you know, the demonstrators had been there, there'd been some trouble out front of the stadium, and John Angelos basically tweeted out his support for the demonstrators who had peacefully demonstrated. He wasn't castigating the police. He wasn't condoning the violence, the storefront windows that had been broken into, the police cars that were trashed. He wasn't condoning that, but he was expressing empathy for the demonstrators and for the young people who came from their such troubled circumstances in West Baltimore. So he and I hope, you know, as to the previous caller, Tom, I hope he does pick up the book and read it, because I think we do explain these the threads of everything that went into the game, the aftermath of the game, but certainly all the events that led up to it. So I hope he does pick up the book and read it.
And another person who had some things to say kind of unexpectedly was Buck Showalter, the beloved manager. And he was asked a question by a young man named Kendall Hilton. Tell us about him.
Well, Kendall Hilton was a young African-American man who had started a website called Fan Eye Sports. He was originally supposed to cover the very first game that was canceled, the very first game of the Chicago White Sox-Baltimore Orioles series. That he did show up at the stadium. That game was subsequently canceled. He decided 2 days later he was going to take his credential and try to sneak in to cover this game.
Because the credential was only good for Monday.
It wasn't good for Wednesday. So he actually snuck, but not snuck past. They didn't even look at him. He actually waltzed past security, got into the press box, and now he's there watching as this game unfolds. When the game ended, the media horde descended into the bowels of the stadium to go talk to Buck Showalter for his presser, and Kendall Hilton followed them. And he was determined at that point, Tom. He saw himself as a bit of a provocateur, and he was going to ask Buck Showalter a question about what was happening outside. So he waited his turn. And then he said to Buck Showalter, I'm paraphrasing here, he said, Buck, I'm from West Baltimore, the scene of where so much of the trouble happened the other day. What advice can you give to young African-American men like me? And the question threw Buck Showalter.
It's, by the way, a great question.
It's a great question. But, you know, there had been a couple of opening questions, and they were kind of softball, your standard post-game question. How did Ubaldo Jimenez, he was the starting pitcher that day, how did he look? What was it like in the stadium? But now Kendall Hilton wanted to ask Buck this question that was fraught with danger for a man who... Buck Showalter has always been accessible. He's a thoughtful guy, but this question obviously took him by surprise. So he stumbled, he stammered, he started down one path, he started down the other path. And finally he came out with the part of the answer that Kendall Hilton really appreciated. And he said, I have never been black, so I can't tell you what that experience is like. And that question, the way he answered it, the way he looked at Kendall Hilton, just made Kendall Hilton so happy. It was like, this guy is listening to me. And Kendall Hilton went on to say, this is what I've been trying to tell my white friends, that your life is not my life. Your experiences with the police department are not my experiences. And he felt that even though he had, again, stumbled, stammered, finally found his footing, he thought it was a terrific answer from Buck Showalter.
Yeah, and the background you give to Buck's childhood, to Buck's growing up as a white kid in the South.
Right. And Buck's Florida panhandle.
You know, and Buck's father and all of this. It's a fascinating.
Yes, it's all in the book, and I hope people read it.
We have an email from Mark, another person who takes exception to your claim that the game gave a broken city hope. That's, again, the title of the book, When the Crowd Didn't Roar, How Baseball's Strangest Game Ever Gave a Broken City Hope. Mark says there were sensible reasons not to play the game, there were sensible reasons to play the game with fans, and there were sensible reasons to play the game without fans. But to say that playing the game, quote, gave the city hope ignores the fact that there were at least tens of thousands of Baltimore citizens who felt zero hope at that time and still feel that way today. The game changed absolutely nothing for them, and sensible folks knew that it wouldn't, and it didn't.
Well, again, the hope that I talked about was fleeting, and the hope that I talked about really was the hope that many people felt that that day, that Wednesday when the game was over, that it was almost a sigh of relief that the worst of the unrest was over. And a lot of people felt all of the unrest was over. That's the hope that I talked about. It was fleeting, the hope that things would get better in the city and that the city was not irretrievably broken. It didn't turn out that way. The hope that we all felt might materialize largely hasn't.
Major League Baseball is obsessed with records.
Yes.
And weird records and strange records, as well as artifacts. And one of the things I learned reading this book is the job of the authenticators.
Yeah.
There are people in the stadium who authenticate stuff that happened to be part of that event. What does an authenticator do, and what did they authenticate on that day?
Well, it all started years ago. There was a big scandal, a big memorabilia scandal, Tom, where people were peddling memorabilia that wasn't authentic. Major League Baseball stepped in. Now there are two Major League Baseball authenticators at every game. These are mostly retired law enforcement people, some active but off-duty law enforcement people. The Orioles knew this was going to be a significant game, a historic game, so they had these two guys there. By the way, they're there at every Major League. Every Major League game has two authenticators. These men were responsible for authenticating everything. The Orioles changed the bases three times during that game. They authenticated that. Broken bats, bats that weren't broken, balls that were used, scorecards, they authenticate everything. That's their job. And this is to ensure that the memorabilia you have, that you get from these games, is authentic. A lot of that memorabilia was going to end up in Cooperstown at the Hall of Fame. And some of it, the majority of it actually is now in the Orioles' private collection. So it's all authenticated.
Just have about an hour. We just have about a minute left in the hour. 2 days after this game, Marilyn Mosby, the state's attorney, announced criminal charges against police officers.
Yep.
Of course, ultimately, none of them were convicted. What happened to the attendance of the Orioles for the rest of that season? Because we hear from arts organizations like the BSO or the Science Center or the Aquarium that they said that their attendance really took a hit after the unrest that happened in April of that year.
Yeah, the Orioles' attendance also took a hit, and in subsequent years, it hasn't rebounded. There's no question that we're still feeling the after effects of the Freddie Gray unrest. There's no doubt about it. Bars, restaurants, hotels downtown, businesses never rebounded. And there's no question that we're still feeling the effects. And the Orioles are, this year, of course, they have a team that that is not playing well, so you kind of expect attendance to go down this year.
Ain't hard to get a ticket this season, that's for sure. Well, Kevin Coward, good to see you. Thanks so much. Congratulations
on the book. Great to see you, Tom. Thanks so much.
Kevin Coward, the book is called When the Crowd Didn't Roar, How Baseball's Strangest Game Ever Gave a Broken City Hope. Kevin will be reading from the new book on the 30th of June at 2 o'clock at the Rosedale branch of the Baltimore County Library, and we'll have a link to that event on our website, wipr.org/midday. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, it's Midday at the Movies to mark the 75th anniversary of D-Day. Our movie mavens Jed Dietz, he's the former director of the Maryland Film Festival, as well as Washington Post film critic Ann Hornaday, will talk about some of their favorite films that take up the complicated subject of war. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews The Play That Goes Wrong at the Hippodrome Theater here in Baltimore. That's coming up tomorrow. Lunch today was provided by Dangerously Delicious Pies. They've got locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street, on the Square in Canton, as well as at 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. You can find more information on the web at dangerouspiesbalt.com. I'm Tom Hall. Life in the Balance is up at the top of the hour after the news from NPR, so stick around. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.